In this part of Focus, we will be talking about the environment and approaching it in a way that we have not, I think, in the past. And that is from the perspective of an historian. And our guest for the program is J.R. McNeil. He teaches history at Georgetown University. And we'll be talking about his book, Something New Under the Sun, which is an environmental history of the 20th century world. It's published by W.W. Norton, in which he makes the argument that when you look at all of the changes that have occurred in the 20th century, and certainly they have been profound, it may be that in the long run, the thing that has the most impact, the greatest impact on human beings, will be changes in the environment. Some things that we have done intentionally and many that have been, perhaps most, that have been unintended consequences of decisions we've made about how we're going to live and how we're going to organize society. We'll talk about this subject this morning, and we'd be very happy to have questions and comments from listeners. We just ask people to try to be brief so we can keep things moving along and accommodate as many different people as possible. But anyone's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor McNeil, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
These subjects have been explored, I'm sure, before by geologists and atmospheric scientists and demographers and on and on, various kinds of scientists, both hard and hard scientists and social scientists. And I'm wondering, just to start, how it is you think that that being an historian gives you a different perspective? And what exactly does it really mean to approach environmental issues from an historic perspective?
One way in which it's a different perspective is the obvious one, that as a historian, I am concerned to explain how situations developed, why things happened the way they did, whereas most of the scientists to whom you refer, natural scientists and social scientists, are interested in the present, and particularly when talking about environmental matters, interested in the future, which they often attempt to predict with greater or less success. That's not really my concern. My concern is to try to explain how we have come to the place we are and to connect the environmental developments as closely and logically and clearly as I can to the conventional meat and potatoes of history, that is, social, economic, and political changes.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, one can make those connections. That is, the changes in the environment that we have seen, and we'll talk about some of them specifically, certainly are the result of decisions made in the cultural and political sphere, although not always the, as I mentioned, we're talking here about unintended consequences. One did not deliberately set out to do these things, but because we made other sorts of decisions, these were the end results.
Yes, I argue in the book that the great majority of significant environmental change in our time, in the 20th century, and I think the argument could be applied more generally in all history, the great majority of environmental change is the unintentional byproduct of actions taken for other reasons, and it's unintentional because the people involved weren't taking the environment into account when they made those decisions, or if they did take it into account, which is unusual, they regarded the possible changes as either desirable or nothing to worry about. There are a few cases of intended environmental change on a very significant scale, such as the Soviet draining of the Aral Sea, which is still going on in these post-Soviet days. That was an intentional decision taken in the late 1950s by Soviet leadership to use the water that had hitherto flowed into the Aral Sea to use it for cotton irrigation, mostly in Uzbekistan. And they knew when they did that this was going to spell the end of the Aral Sea, but in their view, the cost was worth it. few people today think so.
I think it's important to make the point when you look at the 20th century, when you look at the degree of change that took place, just how significant that is, because some people might approach this and say, well, human beings have been on the planet for a long time. We have been living in organized societies for some time. The domestication of agriculture goes back some way, and so on and so forth. And they might say, well, really, what's so important about the last 100 years? In fact, when you take a look at the statistics that you present and look at things like population increase, industrial output, energy use, waste produced, there have been very, very significant increases in these things, particularly in things like total world urban population, industrial output, energy use. Those things have increased very significantly just in the last 100 years.
Indeed they have, and that's part of the reason why I chose to focus on the 20th century in this book. It is quite true, as you said just a few moments ago, that human beings have been around a long time. Agriculture has been around for about 10,000 years, complex stratified societies for about 5,000 years, and it's also quite true that human beings have been changing the environment for all that time, at least, at the very least, since we learned how to use fire, which might be about 500,000 years ago. But the scale of things has changed in modern times and changed very dramatically. And that is what I was, perhaps above all else, trying to point out and make as clear as possible in this book. The scale of things has changed dramatically. And beyond that, there are a few kinds of environmental change that have gone on, did go on in the 20th century, that were new, mainly connected with new technologies, new kinds of chemicals that had previously not existed. And when you add all that up, it seems to me that this is a large-scale and basic kind of historical change, a sea change in the human relationship to the environment that needs to be brought out into bold relief and understood for what it is.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, J.R. McNeil. He's professor of history at Georgetown University. And if you're interested in reading more on the subject, his book is Something New Under the Sun, An Environmental History of the 20th Century World. It's published by W.W. Norton. And questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Perhaps we should talk specifically about some of the areas that you discuss in the book. And you talk about a number of things, including population issues, use of water, soil erosion, the amount of energy that's produced and waste that's produced and so forth. Maybe let's talk about some of these things in the order that you deal with them in the book, and talk about soil erosion, which is something that I imagine doesn't get a great deal of attention unless you're in an area where there is a lot of agriculture, and certainly it is something that farmers are concerned about. But here, this is an area where, because agriculture has intensified a great deal around the world, particularly, and again, in this last 100 years, that there has been significant soil lost in that period of time, and interestingly enough, even though it was a time when agricultural output increased, we're producing more food, and yet there has been this significant loss of topsoil.
Yes, there certainly has, and listeners in your footprint might be particularly aware of this, because in the Midwest, in Illinois and Iowa, in the last 100-150 years, a great pulse of soil erosion has taken place. And this is not unique to that part of the world. It's part of a general pattern, at least I believe so. I see three great pulses of soil erosion in the history of the world, and the first one was connected to the emergence of agriculture from the river valleys in very ancient times. But the modern one, excuse me, the second one, connected to the worldwide expansion of mainly European settlers in the 18th, particularly the 19th and early 20th century. And this is the one in which Illinois and Iowa were prominently involved. And the third great pulse is going on now after about 1950 with the agricultural colonization of the tropics. But in your part of the world, about half the soil, topsoil, has been lost since these lands were first broken to the plow in the early and mid-19th centuries. And if it weren't for the chemical transformations of agriculture, which have made much higher yields possible, the unfortunate consequences of the soil erosion would be obvious. But plant agronomists and soil chemists have managed to mask the effects of soil erosion in many parts of the world, notably the American Midwest. So it's not easy to see in terms of total agricultural output, but if you live on the land and know a little bit about the history of the land on which you live, then it is easy to see.
Perhaps going hand in hand with that is water and use of water. And as I mentioned a little bit ago, you list statistics and talk about this, the factor of change and how dramatic change has been in the last 100 years. Just to take a couple of these, for example, the use of water has increased over the last 100 years by a factor of 9. Irrigated area has increased around the world by a factor of 5. So here again, we're looking at the use of a resource that perhaps in the past we would have thought would have been simply inexhaustible, maybe just because there is so much water in the world, not all of it fresh. But how much of this is really related to the need for water in agriculture, and how much of this is also a population issue because more people are obviously going to consume more water?
Well, they're interconnected. The needs that agriculture presents in terms of heightened demand for irrigation water, part of this is driven by rising population, more mouths, more demand for food, more demand for irrigation water. But overall, the share of fresh water used by irrigation remains quite high. It's about two-thirds of the global freshwater used today. It used to be more than that. It was about 90% at the beginning of the 20th century. And what's happened is that industry has taken a larger share, and mundane uses like drinking water and sort of domestic household use has also risen slightly, but not very much. The big change, aside from the tremendous overall expansion in the use of fresh water, the big change is the rise of industrial uses, which now take about a quarter of all fresh water used around the world. The big thing here, though, is the inequality of the distribution of fresh water. There are some places where, even though water is used much, much more than it used to be, it doesn't really matter because there's still plenty. There's a big buffer. But there are many places around the world where this isn't true, where there is already significant shortages in fresh water, and those shortages are going to grow worse in the fairly near future.
Hmm. Well, we can certainly even see it here in the United States. If you compare, for example, here in this part of the country, we're fortunate. We have an adequate supply of groundwater, and it's not particularly an issue, but certainly in the western United States, it is. And there, people have to think much more about conservation. One might argue that here we should also be thinking about it, but I don't really think that we are.
Well, not very much in the Midwest, because the rainfall is high enough and the droughts are comparatively rare. So that it's not a pressing issue, although even in the Chicago area, there's some problems with the groundwater supply. Chicago is such a thirsty city. and there are restrictions on how much you can draw from Lake Michigan. So it does draw groundwater from around northern Illinois and even southern Wisconsin. There are some issues there, but they're not acute issues the way the groundwater issues are in the semi-arid and arid west in the southwest Colorado River Basin, and also in the high plains states where a great aquifer called the Ogallala Aquifer has been drawn down since it was first tapped in a significant way in the 1930s. It's been drawn down by half or more. And a lot of the ranching and agriculture that goes on there in West Texas and the western parts of Oklahoma, Nebraska, Kansas, and eastern Colorado, these are all dependent on the Ogallala Aquifer. And it's slowly and not so slowly disappearing. This is a major issue for people who live in that part of the world, and also for the rest of us who eat the food produced on the basis of Ogallala water. So that's much more acute than the situation in Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Let me mention just a couple of other things that are certainly also connected. In fact, all of this is connected in one way or another. But this is the issue I'm thinking of primarily is air pollution.
Mm-hmm.
But also this is definitely connected with things like industrial output and urban population. Here in the United States, I think we've actually made some progress on that issue over the last, say, 20 years, certainly since the 1970s and since the U.S. EPA came to be. But certainly that we still see in cities some problems. And around the world, some of the greatest environmental problems are in urban areas, places like Mexico City, for example, that's famous around the world for maybe having some of the worst air pollution anywhere. The total world urban population over the last 100 years increased by a factor of 13. At the same time, industrial output by a factor of 40, energy use by a factor of 16. All of these things certainly are connected. And as I say, I think here in the United States, maybe we don't think very much about air pollution, but it is a very serious problem in other places around the world, big cities, and also in countries as large as China.
Well, I would say, with respect to thinking about it in the United States, it depends where you live in the United States.
Mm.
There are people, perhaps not that many, in your listening area, but people around the United States who have every reason to think about air pollution and do so on a fairly regular basis. People in Houston, for instance, which now has the worst air quality in the United States, having overtaken Los Angeles for that dubious honor within the last year. But broadly speaking, what you say is exactly right. In the last 30 or 40 years, the United States has significantly moderated its urban air pollution problems. So has Japan, so has most of the Western European countries, so that the acute air pollution, urban air pollution problems are now to be found mostly in the poorer countries of the world and the ex-Soviet sphere, Russian cities. Probably the worst of all among large cities are the Chinese coal-burning cities, which have particularly noxious air. Although some of the gigantic cities, Mexico City, Bangkok, Lagos in Nigeria, all of these have acute air pollution problems, which kill thousands of people every year. It's not a trivial matter. It's not just an aesthetic issue. It's a fundamental health issue where air pollution is serious.
We are already at the midpoint. We have a couple of callers we'll get right to. Let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with J.R. McNeil. He's professor of history at Georgetown University. His book, Something New Under the Sun, is an environmental history of the 20th century world, and it's published by W.W. Norton. It is in bookstores now if you'd like to look at it. And questions are welcome, 333 WILL or 9455. That's for Champaign Urbana folks. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-WILL. Our first caller is here locally in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. Now, correct me if I'm misinformed about this, but it seems like I remember hearing somewhere that we're either already at or fast approaching a time when there are more people alive on the planet today than all the people who have lived and died in the whole history of the Earth. Is that the case?
It's a little bit difficult to count because nobody has a very good idea of how many people have ever lived on Earth. But the best guesses in this department suggest that we haven't reached that point where half the people who have ever lived are now alive, but we have reached a point where perhaps about a fifth of the years that human beings have ever lived were lived in within the last 100 years. So the situation isn't quite as dramatic as what you heard, but it's still pretty dramatic.
Well, I just noticed it seems like everywhere I go that, you know, the urban sprawl is just eating up more and more of the countryside. I mean, you certainly see it around here, and anytime I go up to Chicago, it just seems like, you know, more and more farmland's getting gobbled up all the time. So regardless of whether the soil's eroding away, we're, you know, taking it out of production regardless by building on top of it.
That's definitely true. And Chicago, or Chicagoland, one might say, is a pretty good example of it, although there are many places where it's going on even faster. In Chicagoland, it's prime farmland that's being paved over and developed for either residential purposes or commercial purposes. Elsewhere, it's often not prime farmland, but the pattern is very much a worldwide one. Mind you, that's connected not merely with overall population growth, but connected to urbanization, which is going on much faster than population growth.
Do you have a statistic for what the carrying capacity of the Earth is at our current consumption level? How many people could, you know, be sustained?
Right. There are millions of people who've tried to make such calculations, and if you're really keen on the subject, I recommend you have a look at a book by a guy named Joel Cohen, which is called How Many People Can the Earth Support? Unfortunately, he doesn't give you any single answer. He gives you a lot of answers. But I do not have a single statistic for it, and I don't know that you really can have a single statistic for it, because technologies are always changing, and the efficiency with which we as a species use water and produce food and do all the things that we do that are crucial to making such a calculation, all these things are changing all the time. So that's a bit of a weaselly way to answer your question, but I think it's the only intellectually sound way to answer the question.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call. Let's go to someone else here. This is Joliet, line number four. Hello.
Hi, I'm so happy to hear this subject discussed, and I've often wondered and would love an answer to why or who regulates the use of water in this country. Is it regulated? As I fly over the area of the country where I grew up, where they were only able to produce wheat, now they have all these water wheels that surely must not be very efficient because it's so dry out there. I think probably all the water that is sprayed through the air is evaporated by at least half or 75% before it hits the ground. My question is, why is this country allowing these deep aquifers to be tapped for growing crops that were never able to be grown before without tapping deep aquifers, when Illinois has and other states around us have such excellent waterfall and soil, excellent soil, and could grow those crops. They don't have to grow wheat. Why do we allow that in this country? Do you know?
Well, I do have a bit of an answer. Tell me, where is it that you grew up?
I grew up in southwest Kansas, in Dodge City, in that environment.
Right, right. Yeah, what you're referring to, I think, might be what farmers call center pivot irrigation.
Yes.
You fly over and you see a big circle
exactly.
in the landscape that might be green in a brown, arid-looking landscape. That's an innovation in irrigation technique that might be 20 or 30 years old in the state that's now used quite widely around the world.
Correct.
Why does this happen, you say? Well, the main reason is that irrigation has certain advantages from the farmer's point of view. They can, with irrigation, in effect, make it rain when they want it to rain, which dry farmers can't do. They have to trust to luck.
Correct.
So irrigation has certain advantages, and wherever the legal system is such that whoever owns the land has rights to use subsurface waters, and that's pretty widely the case in the western United States, then farmers have every incentive to tap underground water, use the efficiencies of irrigation, produce their crops actually at lower cost than someone trying to produce the same thing, counting on rainfall, could do. So it's a combination of the legal system and then the realities of market competition among farmers.
I see. Well, I grew up in during the Dust Bowl, so I'm well aware of the problems concerned with the low rainfall and during that era when they planted perhaps three times in one season and it was all blown out of the ground, and these people were really, in deep trouble. Many of them lost their land, etc. But I just don't understand why we allow this tapping of the deep aquifers. If could we not one day have a Sahara Desert there that's even so much worse than it is now?
Well, remains to be seen, of course. But barring some shift in rainfall patterns, we're not likely to get a genuine Sahara Desert in southwestern Kansas or anywhere on the high plains. It could well be that the Ogallala Aquifer will be tapped out in 30 to 40, 50 years, in which case the kind of agriculture and ranching that's been going on there for since the Second World War will have to depart. And then one's likely to get an abandonment of farms and ranches and a reversion to older patterns of vegetation, that is the high plains grasslands of that existed, say, 200 years ago.
Yes.
That's not quite a Sahara Desert.
No.
But it's not a very productive landscape from the human point of view.
Correct. They could have a lot of buffalo grass.
Yes.
But
and indeed, some people argue that the smartest way to use the high plains is to let it revert to buffalo grass and let buffalo roam.
Yes.
That's an unpopular idea with people who live out on the high plains,
but there
are some folks who think that's the thing to do.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your insight.
Well, thanks for the call. I want to just return to the population issue just for a moment, because in the last few years, I don't know how many, maybe five or so, maybe a little bit more, we have been hearing a lot about the problem of not enough people in many industrialized countries. And I think that there is a concern that we're moving toward the point where births won't equal deaths, and that we'll have significant problems with simply having enough people to perform the needed work and so forth in places in Europe and in Japan. In addition to having the significant social issue of a very large segment of the population being older. And that, I think, has led some people to say that the earlier concerns that were voiced by people like Paul Ehrlich and others about the problem of population and its impact on the environment, this led people to say, we don't have to worry about that anymore. Look at what's happening in Italy and Japan and France and Germany, where they're actually the population numbers are declining. How now do we think about the problem of population?
Hey, I want to say one thing first. And Russia. Russia is the one place where the decline in the birth rate relative to the death rate is so pronounced that population is shrinking there faster even than any of the places that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Well, Paul Ehrlich and others no doubt oversold the direness of population growth when they were trying to draw attention to the issue in the 1960s. I'm sure that Ehrlich and others would say in their own defense that they were alarmist in order to attract attention to the subject, but there's no doubt that they oversold it. The population issue today has taken on a different shape, and it's one characterized by, as you say, sub-replacement fertility, to use the language of the demographers. That is, not enough people being born to make up for other people dying. Sub-replacement fertility in several countries, mainly the rich countries around the world, at the same time as still fairly exuberant fertility in the poorest countries of the world, in, for example, most sub-Saharan African countries, Central American countries, and several of the Middle East, Arab countries of the Middle East. So there's great inconsistency around the world, great inequalities in the rates of population growth. And this, in and of itself, is probably the most important thing about world population today, because what it implies is tremendous pressures for migration, international migration, mm-hmm. from the countries with fast-growing populations to the countries with slow-growing or zero population growth. That, of course, is happening, but it's a tremendously touchy issue for social reasons, cultural reasons, racial antipathy reasons. And these pressures are very strong in Europe. They're pretty strong in North America. And they're very strong in Japan. And this is going to be a political hot potato for several decades to come. This, I think, is the most important trend today in world population, rather than the fact of continued overall growth.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I would add to what you just said by saying that it's not just the disparity in population growth between those two, broadly speaking, kinds of countries, but also that the countries that people are migrating from they're stretching their resources, and people are very poor, so that they are migrating to what they perceive of as a better life. And, you know, I personally think that if our country is going to say we're not going to help with family planning programs in countries that have an overpopulation problem, that we should accept people coming into our country. That's just my personal feeling. But I also wanted to comment on the questions about how many people the Earth can sustain. Another aspect of that, in addition to what you said, is not just the changing technology, but that you can support a whole lot more Indians from the Indian subcontinent than if everybody lived in that lifestyle, as opposed to everybody in the number of people in the U.S. If we all had Ford Explorer SUVs, if everybody in the world had those, we couldn't. I wonder if we really could support everybody living at the lifestyle that a lot of Americans do.
Right, so, that is a crucial component in the equation. I understood the caller who asked to put in the qualifying phrase at present levels of consumption. So I wasn't going to try to tweak those, but you're quite right. If you do tweak those, if you ratchet up the populations of India and China to American levels of energy consumption, water consumption, et cetera, then you probably have already exceeded the carrying capacity of the Earth. And correspondingly, if you tweak American consumption levels down to those of India, well, then you would sharply reduce the pressures on the world's resources. Not that this is likely to happen, mind you.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. It's really difficult. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for
the call.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And I would like again to introduce our guest. We're speaking with J.R. McNeil. He's professor of history at Georgetown University, and he's author of the book Something New Under the Sun, An Environmental History of the 20th Century World. It's published by W.W. Norton. And questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Before we find ourselves out of time, I want to talk a little bit about rats and sharks. Since you talk in the introductory section of the book about adaptability and adaptation, it certainly has been argued, and I guess it's true, I wouldn't argue against it, that human beings have been as successful as they have because, as a species, we have been able to adapt to very different kinds of environmental conditions and to changing circumstance. However, it seems that somewhere along the line, we changed what we were doing and moved from adaptability to adaptation. That is, you suggest that some species and human beings have, as a strategy, become very well adapted to a particular set of circumstances, and that can work fine as long as those circumstances don't change. And it may well be, though, that as long as we've been successful doing things a particular way, we may be at the point where circumstances will change and it'll not be quite as easy for us to change because we have been doing it this way for such a long time.
Yeah, let me try to explain that a bit more. I used the analogy of rats and sharks in this discussion. Rats, rather like human beings, are supremely adaptable creatures, and they eat all sorts of things, and they can survive in all sorts of different habitats, whereas sharks are not so adaptable, but are supremely adapted to one thing, that is hunting and killing fairly large fish in the sea. And I use this as an analogy for this aspect of the human condition. Our species is, like rats, supremely adaptable and has been for a long time, ever since we developed big brains. And we're even more adaptable than rats are. But at the same time, in modern history, we have erected institutions, social structures, in a word, civilization, that is actually much less flexible than we are as a biological species. So what I'm saying here is that while there's no imminent concern for the biological survival of the human species, the kind of social structures, institutions, and civilization that we have erected in the last 150, 200 years, really based fundamentally on fossil fuels, this is something that that seems to me makes our society less flexible and more vulnerable to shocks more vulnerable to changing circumstances than previous human societies have been. That's the argument that I'm advancing in the preface of the book, and I guess in the epilogue, too.
Mm-hmm. Let's continue with some callers to Chicago, line number 2.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I tuned in late, so you may have covered what I'm going to talk about, and you have already talked about some of the stuff that I'll bring forward. I think the person who called you and asked why we've allowed the farming of such areas as Kansas, where the resources are so little in comparison with this part of the country. I think what you missed in your reply is that it's our commitment to a laissez-faire economy that's primarily the cause of that. We just wouldn't interfere. We haven't thought of interfering with people going in and doing their own thing.
Well, I think that caller raises a good point, and certainly, Professor McNeil, you do talk in the book about the fact that political decisions certainly have environmental consequences, and again, not always intended.
Yes, indeed, including unconscious political decisions, in which category I would put the ongoing commitment to laissez-faire as regards natural resource use in the United States, which is largely an unexamined commitment, as the caller is pointing out here. With respect to southwestern Kansas, again, and the water issue, I do think that it's, as I put it, the reality of market competition as well as the legal system that brings about the situation that the caller from southwestern Kansas was alluding to. So in there, you do have the commitment to laissez-faire, because that's where that's what permits the continuing realities of market competition, as I put it. But putting the point more generally, I did try in the book to give some attention to the impacts of broad commitments to certain kinds of political systems, or what the academic world calls political economy. And on the one hand, you might put the laissez-faire commitments that the United States goes in for, and sort of on the other end of the spectrum, the command economy of the Soviet Union or China when it was still enthusiastically communist. And each of these has its own kinds of implications for the environment, which are almost entirely unexamined. They're unintended in their consequences, but they're really important.
Can I still continue, or am I off?
Please do.
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
Another area, and not another area, but I think our condition is much more dire than I think is brought forth. What concerns me is that I think the world basically is overpopulated, including the United States. And for instance, in order to meet the market requirements of the rest of the world, the jungles, the forests, the rainforests of the world are being depleted and being left, and the soil is being left bare in Indonesia, the western United States and Canada, the Himalayas. You're getting all sorts of flooding in the Indian subcontinent as a result of this. Our fisheries there, there was something like 17 worldwide world fisheries in the world, and about 13 of them are essentially depleted, are no longer useful for feeding the world population. They've been overfished.
We're getting really short on time here. I hope the caller will forgive me for kind of jumping in, but I only have about a minute, and I want to give our guest a chance to either, if you want to respond again to the comments of the caller, that's fine, or if you can help us.
Sure, I'll try to respond.
Make some kind of...
try to put them in some sort of perspective as well. I don't deny any of these contentions, although the premise that the world is overpopulated and the United States is overpopulated, I think this has to be understood as relative to what. And it might well be that, in my opinion or your opinion, there are too many people on the world, too many people in the United States. But that depends on what you value, and some people have different value systems. So you got to specify in these kinds of blanket statements. I do want to say that in doing the research for my book, which took me 6, 7, 8 years, I was impressed with a couple of things that are relevant here. One is that, and this is kind of a point of departure for this show today, that some of this stuff has been going on for a very long time, and the human species has somehow, with great pain, no doubt, muddled through. That gives me some hope. Second thing relevant here is that some environmental problems have shown themselves to be fairly easily remediable when the political will can be summoned. Urban air pollution is one such example. Now, I said when the political will can be summoned, and that I recognized is a very significant condition to attach. But whenever I hear dire predictions, I always want to say yes, but there's wiggle room, there's room for hope with concerted action.
Well, at that, we're going to have to stop. I appreciate you giving us your time, Professor McNeil. I thank you very much.
My pleasure. It's always nice to talk to fellow Chicagoans and natives of Illinois.
All right. J.R. McNeil, our guest, he's professor of history at Georgetown University. His book, Something New Under the Sun, is published by W.W. Norton.